welcome aboard the Battleship Pretension. I'm Tyler Smith.
I'm David Bax.
And thank you for listening. David.
Yes.
How are you?
I'm good. We're you and I are back on our regular schedule.
Indeed, yes.
For the time being.
For
1 week.
1 week. Yes, because I'm not...
I don't know why we even comment on that. To the listeners don't... I mean, well, they know you weren't here last week.
Right.
But listeners don't know what day we record.
That's
but
true.
But it does feel weird when we record a different day than our usual day. And so, like, we're back
They'll be able to tell when we are off because we will not... do a movie journal
bonus episode. Yeah. Yeah, so any week that there's a movie journal, that means we're back on schedule.
Exactly.
So it feels good. Anyway,
I will mention so I won't be here next week because I'm going to be in Orlando at the International Christian Film Festival. I'm going to be giving a couple of talks, but also I'm just going to be in the Orlando area. So if any listeners would be interested in grabbing coffee or dinner or something like that, just reach out to me, tyler@battleshippretension.com. I won't have a car, but I can tell you the resort that I'm staying at, and you can come meet me at the local BJ's brew house or something. But anyway, it's the same place I've been for the last few years, so I know all the restaurants around. Anyway,
hey, BJ's is good.
It is good,
you can get a Pizookie.
That's yes. And they have surprisingly good fries, just the right amount of crisp, and good ribs as well. That's neither here nor there. What is here right now,
okay,
is Mubi, which is a curated streaming service showing exceptional films from around the globe. Every day, Mubi premieres a new film. Whether it's a timeless classic, a cult favorite, or an acclaimed masterpiece, a movie you've been dying to see, or one you've never heard of before, there are always 30 different films to discover. With Mubi, each and every film is hand-selected, so you'll never spend more time looking for something great to watch than actually watching something great. It's like your own personal film festival, streaming anytime, anywhere. Currently available on Mubi is Zhang Yimou's The Flowers of War, his epic film about the Nanking Massacre, starring Christian Bale. Also available is James Marsh's Project Nim, which I haven't seen, but you did, and
yeah,
you
liked it quite a bit.
Yeah,
a lot, yeah.
What is it about?
It's about a chimpanzee that was raised... by a family?
Yeah.
Half kid, half pet, I guess, something like that?
Yeah, and some experiments were performed.
It was 8 years ago.
Yeah, and from what I read, it's heartwarming and also deeply disturbing.
Yeah, it's very upsetting.
Yeah.
Yeah, so definitely check that out on Mubi.
Yeah, and also, James Marsh has become, a more just accessible filmmaker over the years, but I feel like... Many years ago,
accessible is a nice way of saying he makes bad movies now.
Well,
he made The Theory of Everything,
bad. Yeah, but there was a time because he made The King, right?
Right.
Which I don't know if you've ever seen The King.
I haven't. Is that Gael Garcia Bernal?
It is, and William Hurt, and it's a very good movie, but also a very disturbing one. And then Project Nim once again seems like straightforward and very family friendly, but also very disturbing. But anyway, so you can find these films available at Mubi, and you can try Mubi free for 30 days at mubi.com/battleship. That's mubi.com/battleship for a whole month of great cinema for free.
And I want to tell you about TweakedAudio.com. You see, TweakedAudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They're so stylish. They're so colorful. I love them. They look great. They sound great. Tyler and I use them each and every day. Today, I was listening to a whole bunch of new stuff. I was listening to... Tyler, have you listened to Better Oblivion Community Center?
Yes.
You have?
No.
Oh. You would like it, I think.
Okay.
Because it's Connor Oberst, a.k.a. Brad Edge.
Okay, yeah.
And Phoebe Bridgers. I don't know if you know her, but it's a band they have together. They did an NPR Tiny Desk concert. Have you ever watched any of those?
No.
Bands or whatever just show up at the NPR offices and stand behind a desk and, play three songs. It's cute.
All right.
So they did a Tiny Desk concert. I listened to that. I listened to the new album by Rico Nasty and... Kenny Beats. I don't know who Kenny Beats is really, but I like Rico Nasty.
Okay.
I listened to the new YG song, Stop Snitching, which is apparently a Tekashi 6ix9ine diss track. I don't know. I can't keep track of rap beefs. I can't do it. But this is the most,
I feel like you're speaking in code. whenever you start talking about rap, I'm like, I don't know any of these terms.
Yeah, but this Stop Snitching, man, it's not just some... It's not a friendly beef. He's got some words for Tekashi 6ix9ine.
Really?
None of which I can say.
Oh, yeah, I guess that makes sense.
All of them have the N-word in them. Anyway, but the point is, all this stuff, I spent a whole day today, for ones, not listening to music by people who had recently died, which you know is a problem that I have, that I'm constantly making myself sad listening to people, music by people who died. And it all sounded great in my tweakedaudio.com earbuds, and they're available to you. You can have the same experience at a low, low price over at tweakedaudio.com. But if you use the offer code pretension at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low, low price and no shipping charges. So please, everyone, go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code pretension.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Tyler?
Yes?
Let's get into it, shall we?
Indeed.
We have a guest. A first-time guest.
Yes.
Why don't you tell us?
But not the last time.
I hope not.
We'll see. David, I couldn't help but notice that as you were saying we have a guest, you were really segmenting it like we have a guest.
Yeah.
And here's why that's appropriate, because our guest today is the author of Best Movie Year Ever. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. I worried that last one was more of an ellipsis than a period. But anyway, it is Brian Raftery. Am I saying that correct?
Wow,
okay.
Very good, man.
Yeah.
No one gets that name right ever.
Yeah. Oh, it's even like right up until the moment, it's like, I'm going to say Raftery and I'm going to feel bad about it.
Why do we default? Like, I don't know anyone named Raftery.
Best friend growing up, his name is Cody Raftery.
And Jerry Raftery, of course.
Yeah.
You know, everyone's heard 70s musician. So,
yeah. Okay.
But yeah, so. And I seem to recall, not that I'm looking to make fun of your name, but when I first saw it, I was like, okay, it's not Raftery. Note to self, got to keep that in mind. It's Raftery, sort of like when you walk into a room and the ceilings are really high. It's like, it's very Raftery in here. That's like, okay, that's how it's gonna. Sure. That's how I'm gonna remember. But anyway, Brian, the author of Best Movie Year Ever. Welcome to Battleship Pretension.
Thanks so much, guys. This is great. Thank you.
No, thank you.
I'm here to respond to the YG Tekashi 6ix9ine beef, right? That's why I'm here.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, do you have any thoughts?
You've talked about your book enough. We get it. Okay. By way of an introduction to what we're partially here to talk about.
Well, we gotta get to know Brian first.
I will in a second.
Oh, okay. All right.
So I was on Facebook the other day, and what was that?
I've heard of it.
probably all bad things, and rightfully so. And as I was scrolling, I saw a promoted post talking about Best Movie Year Ever.
Oh, really? Oh,
and I was like, how exciting. I'm going to have the author of that on the show. And sure enough, and it's all about how 1999 is the best movie year ever. And against my better judgment, I chose to click on the comments.
Oh, no.
For that post.
Oh, boy. I wouldn't do that.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is it was a promoted post. So it's like, okay, so this is for everybody.
Yeah.
Or, you know, everybody that fits the algorithm. And sure enough, it would appear a lot of people do not agree with the assertion that 1999 is the best movie year ever. And I found myself getting defensive on your behalf.
Oh, thank you.
And mine. Our longest episode to date is with Josh Fadem, in which we recorded for 4 hours about 1999 being the best movie year ever.
Yeah.
And so as
is that
I was
a premium episode?
No.
No.
2007 is our premium episode.
Okay, so the 1999 episode is free to listen to.
Yeah, for 4 hours.
You can put on Magnolia and then listen to the podcast, and it will almost match up. It'll come close.
Yeah, it's just treated as like a commentary. But anyway.
Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet. That might have been 98.
I think so.
And so as I was looking, and everyone was just being really smug and shitty, and it just really frustrated me. And so then I thought, well, I never contribute to comment sections, but I simply, I just, nobody, I haven't seen anyone respond to me or anything, but I simply said, yes, it is the best movie year ever. And so that is partially what we're here to talk about today. But first things first, yes, we want to know about you and how you arrived at the inevitable conclusion that 1999 is the best movie
ever. I'm not necessarily co-signing Tyler here. I think there are other contenders, but
sure.
1999 is the most important movie year to me. It's the year I got my driver's license, which means it was the year that I was able to go see whatever movie I wanted to see.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was a very formative year. But no, before we do that, okay, two things. When you call the book best movie year ever, you're kind of inviting people.
I want people to argue. I mean, that's the whole point. And it's not, you know, it's not a critical book. It's not a it's not a work of film criticism. It's a lot of interviews with the filmmakers of that year. But I always, you know, in 1999, I graduated college and I went to work at Entertainment Weekly. I was an intern there. And that fall, they did a cover story called 1999, the year that changed movies, before 1999 was over. So even back then, like 20 years ago, there was this feeling like, this has been kind of an extraordinary time. And so we knew when we named the book that it would absolutely irk people, but we also know if you put it in that Simpsons comic book guy best movie year ever. I think most people, I mean, people who have been frustrated with me, I think they also, they don't come up to me and slap me in the face. They just come up and go, but what about this year, that year, which is exactly what you want, because you want everyone to say, what about 1939? What about 1950? What about 2007? Mm-hmm. So part of the title was definitely to like push people to argue. But I do think it's a pretty great year, and it's like, and I have the same, I also have a personal, I mean, obviously I moved to New York that year. I went to my first screenings and screening rooms, which when I was like 23 was absolutely the most amazing experience, where it's like, I can watch this. I can watch She's All That for free in a screening room. And it's nice and quiet. But I also mean, that was
that really your first?
No, it wasn't. I think okay. I'm trying with, I know the first screening I went to ever, like a real screening room screening, was The Phantom Menace, which I somehow talked myself into seeing like 5 days before it came out, which I was a very resourceful 23-year-old to get into that screening.
I'm going to tell you my, this is getting way inside baseball, but my first press screening was not at a screening room. It was at a multiplex, because that's how they do the sort of all media screenings here. My first press screening was Ivan Reitman's No Strings Attached.
Oh, wow.
Starring Ashton Kutcher and Natalie Portman. My first screening room experience is a movie that no one remembers. And I'm blanking on the director's name, but it's called The Vanishing on 7th Street with Hayden Christensen.
Yeah.
It's a director I really like. He made Session 9. He made The Machinist. What is that guy's name?
Brad Anderson.
Brad Anderson. Film. It's not bad. John Leguizamo, Hayden Christensen. It's a weird movie. But I had two very ignominious first screening, like be member of the press experiences.
My first was Season of the Witch, directed by Dominic Senna, who made California with a K,
which we just talked about, which I did not care for. But, so you say you moved to New York in 1999. We'll get back to that. I have to ask the question I ask every first-time guest. Where are you from?
I am born in New York, but then my parents moved to the suburbs of Philadelphia, and it drives my wife crazy because I always try to make it sound like I'm a lifetime New Yorker, where I'm like, well, I was born in New York. I mean, I have my New York City street cred card. So I'm from the outside, like the suburbs outside of Philadelphia, and then I grew up there. My parents were both newspaper people, so I grew up very aware. I mean, I read in the Philadelphia Inquirer every day. Kerry Rickey and Desmond Ryan were the film critics there, and I would read their reviews the Fridays they came out. We'd watch Siskel and Ebert on the weekends. My mom had tons of movie books and she just watched old movies a lot. So I grew up in a very sort of like media stuffed movie friendly family.
So I was going to ask you, how'd you get into movies? But you kind of answered the question.
I liked baseball when I was growing up. I liked the Philadelphia Phillies, and I liked movies growing up. And then I met Pete Rose when I was 6 or 7, and he was such a dick that I think I was like, you know what? Forget sports. I like movie stars, because I'm sure they're much
nicer. Yeah, they're great. I'm sure you've never had an experience with them.
I actually still stay with the Phillies up to like 85, 86, 87. But I think because my mom and dad had so many movie books, and I was talking to someone today about, like, you know, my mom had like a charter subscription to Premiere, and I got Entertainment Weekly, and we got the New York Times. So I read about movie making so much, and I would read, you know, Ebert would do these movie guides, and Leonard Maltin had them too, but Ebert's, and they're both great, but you know, Ebert and the Philadelphia Inquirer and Maltin all pushed out these movie guides, and my brother and I would read the, we would especially read the horror movie descriptions because we weren't allowed to watch those movies. So we would just like sit there and read these four paragraphs. You're like, what do you think Altered States is about though? Like, what could this be like? It's got, it's got violence, adult situations, and nudity. So we know it's kind of grown. Like, so even when I wasn't watching movies, I was either absorbing them through very old issues of Mad magazines, or like movie guides, or I was watching them on the couch. My mom would put on a Hitchcock movie in the middle of the day, and I would just sit and watch some of it with her. And I mean, I watched Rear Window when I was like 10. She doesn't remember this at all, but like I watched Rear Window when I was like 10 or 11, which is like an insanely crazy movie to watch at that age. I mean, no matter how grown up you think you are, it's a pretty, I mean, it's a pretty intense film. And I think I just love sitting there and watching movies. And my mom knew so much about the history that she would go, oh, that actor is in this and that. And I did like a fourth grade paper on Cary Grant when he died. Like, I didn't know much about Cary Grant. Yeah. I'd seen like two of his movies, but I was very much, I just loved Hollywood. So it was always like, I moved to New York, and then a couple years ago, I moved to LA, and I'm just sort of like, the two cities I grew up fascinated with are the two cities I wound up gravitating toward in my life.
I apologize to listeners for the alarm outside. It's
which apparently has this hair trigger. Yeah. Like, the slightest thing makes it go off.
Couple of things. I had a very, very different, very similar experience. My parents got delivered to them the Catholic Review.
Oh,
and that would have weekly, it would have like capsule reviews of movies that were out, but it would also have, this movie is inappropriate because it has this, this and this, which was the, like, I gotta see that. I gotta see Raising Cain, which I never saw, but it was like,
oh, Raising Cain's kind of fun. Yeah.
But I was like, oh, the Catholic Review really wants to warm me away from this. I gotta see Raising Cain.
You can read all about Raising Cain in Cinematic Suffering, reviews of terrible movies by me, Tyler Smith.
And then this alarm is driving me crazy, and so I can't remember what the other thing I was going
to
say was.
I think it's a Catholic Review. They've heard you talking about Raising Cain, and they're coming in to swoop in. Like, you still can't. It's still not appropriate. Yeah.
Once a Catholic, always a Catholic, David.
Oh, so, yeah, no, you mentioned Rear Window. One of my favorite things. So I've lived in Los Angeles for 14 years now. And I work somewhat in the industry, and also because of being a member of the press, I get to go on to lots, a lot, and has not lost its luster for me.
No,
I still love movie lots. And yeah, a lot of them, including Paramount, which is the oldest, it's the only one still in Hollywood, and it's the old RKO lot. And it has a lot, what a lot of the lots will do outside of each soundstage. It has a plaque that's like, here's the notable stuff that was shot here. So, you know, you're like, this is where they shot Rear Window. Doesn't make me think of it, because Rear Window was that entire sort of courtyard they constructed on a set was on a soundstage was constructed on the Paramount lot. And it's great to be standing there, and also weird to be like, oh, and then 30 years later, they shot episodes of Angel here.
Right.
Like in the same soundstage.
No, I mean, I did a bunch of interviews for the book on like the Fox lot or the Paramount lot. And every time I'd be finished, I would just be like, how can I make an excuse to wander? I mean, I've been coming out here for like 20 years to interview people and for writing about movies and stuff, but like, I never get, if I get to the point where I'm jaded by the lots, I should just move out of here. Cause I live in Burbank now. So when I drive by the Warner Brothers lot, I'm so like 13 again. I'm like, that's where they make the motion pictures. Kids. It's like, I'm like, there's the water tower. My kids only know that from Animaniacs, but like, it really is exciting. And the Paramount lot is so awesome. Cause the last time I went, I had just rewatched Sunset Boulevard, and I totally forgot that, like, oh yeah, I think the bungalows that they use in that movie are actually on the Paramount lot. And I was walking by, I was like, even if I'm not right, I think I'm right near where they shot Sunset Boulevard. It was so fun to walk by that. I love, the lot experience is great. And it's also like, it's a great place to go work for a day if you're like doing interviews, because it's like, you get nice parking when you're interviewing a big executive, and you get lots of water bottles. It's a great experience. Yeah,
well, you can park at the Paramount lot. They have a sunken part of the Paramount lot that is also a water tank.
Oh, it's great.
I want to say it was probably used for a bunch of stuff, but the first one that comes to mind, I think, Star Trek IV, when they're in the ocean.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because Star Trek is a Paramount movie, so I think that's the one I always go
sense,
to.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can, most of the time it's like this sunken part of the parking lot, but then they can empty it out and fill it with water. And I once, when I was a PA working on the Paramount lot, I once saw Johnny Knoxville making Jackass 2 Clearly on a break from set, just sitting at the edge of that like water tank looking sad.
Oh my gosh. He was making a classic movie though. I do actually Jackass 2 and Jackass. I would never watch the show that much, but those two movies were two of the most fun in theater experiences I had like in this new century.
I never saw the second one. There's a third one too, isn't there?
They're all pretty fun. I mean they're like, I made a terrible mistake, like my daughter was way too young on YouTube. I put up the clip from the first one where they go like zip lining over the alligator tank with like the meat hanging out from their underwear, and I was like, why am I showing this to my daughter? She thought it was hilarious. She did not want to go anywhere near an alligator tank at that point, so maybe it's for the best. Good preventive lesson, I guess. But yeah,
I also love those movies. I ended up meeting the Jackass guys for real at a later PA gig. I was a PA at a place that did motion capture for video games, and they made a Jackass video game in like 2007.
Wow.
I think
I barely remember that.
And so they did some of the motion capture there, and those guys, like, they walk around on guard all the time. Like, they're like walking around like covering their nuts.
Of course, they watched the first Jackass movie. They know what happens.
But I did get to see Steve-O's full back tattoo of himself in person.
That's amazing.
Because they were doing, he was like dripping sweat because they're doing all this stuff in mocap, and then so he hadn't happened to take a cigarette break at the same time I did, and he came out and just took his shirt off because he was covered in sweat, and I was like, oh, there it is. Anyway, that's not a 1999 movie. None of that is. How do we pivot, Tyler or Ryan? How do we pivot into the?
As you were, you know, a big movie fan. You've been writing about movies for a long time. How did you arrive at this subject, at this topic? Was it because, like, okay, 2019, we're coming up on 20 years, or did it just kind of happen just on its own and it was a coincidence?
Kind of both, because so the book originally in 2016, I started really thinking about Y2K, because I think I was pretty sure the world was going to end in 2016. I'm not sure what happened in 2016. Was there a big national but I really was thinking about
Cubs won.
Yeah. But I really was
about that.
I was really thinking about, like, because there was a lot of sort of apocalyptic culture kind of coming back. So I was thinking about 1999, and I was thinking about, well, if you look at all those events, if you look at what happened that year, whether it's Columbine or whether it's Napster or whether it's the, you know, the battle in Seattle or whether it's the movies or whether it's Eminem, Britney Spears, like, it just felt like a really vibrant pop culture year. So originally I was going to just do a book where I write about that. I write about Trump, who ran in 99 or announced he was going to run in 99, and like all these kind of weird events that happened. And then an editor at Simon & Schuster, just out of blue, was like, hey, you've interviewed Mike Judge before, you've interviewed David Fincher, and I know you're doing this 1999 book proposal, would you want to just do it on the movies? And eventually we sort of reached this point where I was like, oh, because he's a really smart guy, he was like, you can write about all these things about the late 90s and what was going on and this weird sort of rush toward Y2K, and you can use the movies. And so that's what the book became. It became, let's talk to as many filmmakers in that year as possible, as many actors, as many executives, and sort of talk about the end of the 90s, both in terms of Hollywood and in terms of sort of America and where the country was, which sounds very lofty and pretentious, but it really, the more I looked at these movies, I think one of the reasons they resonated so much at the time is that you can really see a lot of like late 20th century concerns popping up in these movies. And they're also, it's an exceptionally good year of movies. I mean, like, the list is insane. And every time I would tell someone, well, these are the movies from that year, the list would change every time. People would, it's like, even like the 18th or 19th best movie from that year is pretty great. I mean, the movies I had to cut from the book are like American Movie, which is, in any of the year, American Movie is a book. It's like, so.
Well, I also found that, like, I experienced all these great, because there were great mainstream, you know, the fact that I could get my driver's license and go to the movies, and I was happening to see Three Kings.
Oh my gosh, you know, like, Three Kings was amazing that year,
But as I've gotten older, my tastes have gotten more, I don't know, obscure, pretentious, esoteric, whatever. I still find that, like, Adam McGoyan's Felicia's Journey came out in 1999.
Claire
Denis' Beau Travail came out in 1999. Like, it's, the deeper I go, it's still a great year.
So I was 17 in 1999. And so in the years since, when I was thinking about how great that movie year was, I also thought, you were also 17. So you're a movie lover at 17. Every movie you see, not every movie, but you're falling in love with movies. You're seeing movies that you haven't, that you previously probably would have thought were boring, and now you love them.
Yeah.
So it probably isn't that great of a year. But as time has gone on, and actually, and as David was saying, like, as my appreciation for film deepened, I came to realize, like, no. This is, if not the best movie year, certainly a special movie year. It's this odd little cross-section of old, like, masters like Stanley Kubrick, but then also Martin Scorsese making Bringing Out the Dead, Mike Lee with Topsy Turvy, which I adore. So you have that, but then you also have The Sixth Sense and Being John Malkovich and The Matrix, you know, films that Matrix wasn't the Wachowskis' first film, nor was Sixth Sense, M. Night Shyamalan's first film. But like these movies that just did very well financially.
It's a new class to a filmmaker.
You get this weird thing. And then you've got like smaller, lesser known movies by Woody Allen that are nonetheless marvelous. You have this crazy ass anomaly of The Straight Story.
I know.
From David Lynch. Like it's just this. It not only is it a thing when a year when established filmmakers are making movies, but when they seem to be some of them taking risks and doing something very different than what they usually do. Like, and so it's just fascinating to look at that. And as you said, like you get to number 25 and it's still a movie that many people will just love.
Yeah.
And so as I was looking at that Facebook thing and people were like, what about 1939? And then they list like six movies. Like granted, Wizard of Oz, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Gone with the Wind. Sure. That's fine. No problem but there.
Isn't this recency bias on your part? Like, there probably are 30 great 1939 movies.
Probably, but why didn't they say they listed seven of them?
Because they weren't, the people who were arguing this weren't alive then, and maybe in, what is that? 80 years.
Sure.
Maybe people will only be able to
remember. Facebook. Those who lived through 1939 might not be on Facebook at this point, too.
That's true.
In the year 20, I'm doing the math, 2059 or whatever, maybe people won't be able to, because I'm going to be dead in 2059. And so,
if I have my druthers, then yes, you will be dead by,
So maybe, I don't know. I know we're talking about 1999, but I just want to say it's not every one of those movies is going to be remembered in 80 years. I'm not saying that's right.
Oh, sure.
I'm just saying these other years have good pedigree.
Oh, undoubtedly, yes. But and that's why I think 20 years out, I think it's okay. We now have two full decades of movies that have come out since then, and it also means that we've seen the impact that the movies of 1999. Right. We've seen what the impact that those have had.
Yeah.
And so you look at a movie like Blair Witch Project, which kicked off, maybe not initially, but certainly eventually, like the idea of found footage horror is well established at this point, and that was kicked off by Blair Witch Project. And
oh, absolutely, yeah.
And yeah, it's just certainly to people. Okay, I think it probably is recency bias, but I also think that in the film nerd community, there's a tendency to be suspicious of any claim of greatness in the last 30 or 40 years. Like 39 is well established. Yeah. Anything is like, well, you can't know unless you're like 50 years out.
Well, there was
like,
also,
I think we can.
I mean, there was some, I mean, it's like there was some resistance, especially in the mid to late 80s, which is when I first, as very young, started reading about this idea of the 70s as being the greatest decade. There was pushback against that from some people who were older, who were saying the 70s, I mean, the Star Wars and Jaws decade, like that was the junkiest decade. Now, for me, it's like, I would say the 40s, the 70s, and 90s are my three favorite decades. I mean, I think those are the eras. So, you know, you can certainly look at, you can pull any year from those decades and find interesting stuff. But I like the fact that when people start debating what year it is, what their favorite movie year is, it's a mix of the movies were great, but also it's a mix of like where they were personally in their lives for a lot of them, you know? And I think that's why, you know, certainly a lot of people I talk to are like, what about 94? Which I understand, they're around my age. Or what about, there's a lot of people who are like, oh, 82, 84, who are the kids who sort of loved Amblin coming up. But you know, for me, it's like I gave it that title because I do think for me and for people who are my age, that was the closest at that moment we got to that same thrill of the entire 70s. It's like, and you had this collision of generations. You had, you know, it was like Kubrick and George Lucas and Terrence Malick. I mean, Thin Red Line was technically end of 98, but he basically came out in 99. And then you have and you mentioned all these new filmmakers, but also like there's this insane middle class. It's like Michael Mann and Soderbergh and Fincher and, yeah, and all these directors who had been established for a while, but they, that year, they got so much money to do whatever they wanted. Like, it's crazy. It's like, yeah, they got this full, everyone got this permission slip. It's like, what is your crazy idea? Okay, here's a little bit of pushback, but we're probably going to give you the money you want for it, and you're probably going to be able to release it and make it mostly the way you want to, which is amazing. And that didn't even happen that much in the 70s or 60s, you know?
Yeah. And you also got experiments. I'm only now thinking of Time Code, which is a film that I loved at the time, and I think I still have tremendous respect for. And yeah, that was... Like you said, these movies are greenlit in a way that you're just like, what money did you expect to make off of this studio guy?
I mean, The Insider is like, The Insider is, you know, Joe Roth, the head of Disney, which was a very different Disney than we know now. They used to do a lot more live action, grown up movies. But, you know, it's a movie made by a company that had just merged with ABC a few years. And it's like, it's a movie made by the company that owns ABC, criticizing CBS and also taking on the tobacco industry. And it's R rated. It costs something like $60 to $70 million. It's going to take 4 to 5 months to shoot in multiple countries. By the way, you will never get a sequel to The Insider. You will never get, you will not be able to make t-shirts of like Al Pacino on the phone on the beach. It's like, and Joe Roth at Disney was like, all right, go for it. You know what I mean? It's like, it wasn't, and maybe he wanted an Oscar nomination and it wound up getting them. Maybe he wanted the glory of making, but it's like, they made these movies that were just insane. They were just beyond a gamble at this point to make a movie where you're going to take Russell Crowe, who was like the sexy LA Confidential guy, and be like, here, eat a bunch of hamburgers, drink whiskey for 2 months and age 20 years and look like everyone's dad. And you're going to, this is the movie you're going to make, and put it out at the end of the year for your big push. It's insane. It's insane.
And then the next year it's like, okay, lose that weight, get sexy again. Here's your Oscar.
In all fairness, he was pretty good at yo-yoing at that point. Yeah. But that was I mean, he was like, that's a huge risk. I don't know what The Insider would be now. I mean, it's like, I was thinking of it because there's all this Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos stuff right now as part of the culture, and that book is so good, and there's the HBO documentary, but I think that's how that story would be told now. No one is going to make, they are going to make an Elizabeth Holmes movie. It's not going to be a $70 million Disney movie where they give, I don't know if it's Adam McKay, but they're not going to give him, I mean, Vice is kind of weirdly almost like The Insider, where it's kind of
except terrible.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a little less money and definitely not made with the kind of Michael Mann patience. I really like Adam McKay a lot. I did not like Vice at all, but but I do think I did admire the spirit in which he was making that, which is like, I watched that movie and I was like, this did not seem to have a lot of notes, you know what I mean? It didn't feel like it came out of like the note machine that you see a lot of studios now.
Well, I mean, that's Annapurna. I mean, that's and Megan Ellison, she is great at doing that, but also is apparently the company's apparently losing tons of money, so it's sad.
Yeah, I mean, they put out great movies that like me and my friends see, and then it's about it. I don't know if they're like really puncturing the consciousness in a big way, but you know, I do think that as much as as movie fans, we're all conditioned to like see the movie executives as the man and to be like, oh, they're always, and it is the most fun stories in the book are like David Fincher fighting with Fox or David O. Russell trying to convince Warner Brothers that Three Kings isn't a racist movie. A lot of these executives were just like, they felt indebted to not only make money, but they needed to make good movies. They felt an obligation to it. And I think it's because they had gone through the 60s and 70s, and that had been the era in which they had sparked the movies the same way we all kind of did in the late 90s. And they were like, I want to make movies that are like Easy Rider or The Graduate. Mm-hmm. And these were executives who had seen The Graduate, Easy Rider. And sometimes I don't know if some modern executives even care about movies that are more than 5 years old at this point. So that it was exciting, and everyone got to do what they wanted to do for the most part.
That reminds me of that. There's that great scene in The Player where all the executives are talking about when was the last time any of us went to see a movie. And Tim Robbins is like, I went to see The Bicycle Thieves, and I'm like, oh, I love The Bicycle Thieves, but they don't watch movies.
And
of course, they also called it The Bicycle Thieves.
So I did have a question, because there's something interesting about the fact that these films came out, that this special moment happened in 1999 specifically, like right before Y2K, as you were saying. Do you think that the fact that it's at the end of not only a decade, but a millennium, do you think that either directly or indirectly like influenced the people making it, whether it be the studios or the directors? Like, I not necessarily, I got to get this in before the world ends, but like, like, I want a movie that sort of reflects where we are at the end of the 1900s or the thousands.
Well, I mean, the part of me, and you both know too, it's who knows how the movie development process works, and that nothing, you know, it's like it takes years, and some of these movies take years, and doing the reporting and realizing, like, these movies could have arrived in 98 or 2000, things. Well, no, this is, you know, this is a coincidence, but I don't know if it is a coincidence. I mean, I do think at a certain point there are certain things going on subliminally in the culture. And I think it was when I interviewed Steven Soderbergh for the book, he's like, you know, artists have their antennas up and sometimes you can't kind of see what they're seeing for a long time. But certainly the fact that you had so many movies that were playing out the same ideas in different ways. I mean, if you look at Office Space, Fight Club, and The Matrix, and even American Beauty, it's like, okay, it's four movies about guys, mostly younger middle-aged guys in these white-collar jobs who are trying to push themselves out to find some sort of meaning or existence. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's a coincidence. I mean, I don't know if, you know, Being John Malkovich and Boys Don't Cry, which both address transgender issues in their own ways, people forget that Cameron Diaz sort of starts articulating that. I don't know if that's a coincidence. I don't know if people were really, I think when you look at, it's impossible to look at anything now pre or post 9/11 without feeling like, oh, this is a drag to put these parameters on it. But it does feel like pre 9/11, it's like, it was a navel-gazy time. And that whole idea of like, look, this millennium, this literally does not happen every year. It's like, this is a huge deal. No one knows what's going on. And on top of it, there have been these reports since at least the mid-90s that we had made some huge mistake and miscalculation, and that the lights were going to go out in the best case scenario, or the planes were going to come down. I mean, there really were, if you look at Y2K coverage, there really were a lot of people who were really, really scared by this. And it's interesting now, maybe you guys could speak to this. I mean, it's really interesting to me. I don't know. I sort of forgotten that how much of an evangelical movement parts of Y2K, it was sort of co-opted in some ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jerry Falwell made this big instructional tape, and it was, it really was like they were kind of leading that charge before it even became kind of a mainstream concern, which is really interesting. But I don't know if it's a coincidence, because the Wachowskis wrote The Matrix years earlier.
Yeah.
Kimberly Pierce was trying to make Boys Don't Cry since 94, 95. But I do sort of think it's more fun to look at these movies from this distance and say, this can't be a coincidence. I mean, something, this had to happen for a reason, and this did happen for a reason.
Yeah. In my film history course that I teach, just for my own sanity, I split up all of film history into four periods, which is, or eras. There's the silent era, the classic era, the modern era, and the digital era. And so, and digital eras I have as vaguely like 1990-ish to the present. And in talking about the 90s, one of the things that I say, I call it the age of awareness, because that was the thing that you heard all the time, is people like, we're raising awareness. Mm. And you also saw, I think, you know, Gen X sort of now, they're now adults and they now care about certain things. So you saw movies that dealt with the AIDS crisis and inner city crime and racial inequality and all that because of, you know, Rodney King. And so you had filmmakers making films to accommodate that. And so I do think that, it sort of culminates as like, okay, well, if this whole decade is all about people being aware of of themselves and of deeper issues, and in some cases of movie making itself, you know, you get movies like Scream, which shows a great deal of awareness.
Yeah.
It does make sense that it would all culminate in the last year of that decade to have this really interesting kind of introspective attitude. And then it's always interesting to look at the Oscars of any given year.
Yeah.
And you see that like the five best picture nominees for this amazing year that we're talking about: Cider House Rules,
right? Yeah, sure.
The Green Mile,
yeah.
American Beauty, The Insider, and The Sixth Sense.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I always thought it was kind of cool that they nominated The Sixth Sense.
Yeah.
And I'm a huge fan of The Insider, but it's also standard Best Picture material. And then American Beauty was just a foregone conclusion as the winner. But like you look back now and just like. And David, you didn't like Green Mile at the time.
That's
but
right.
You did like Cider House Rules more at the time than you
and
do
I
now.
And I liked American Beauty at the time, which
yeah,
I
so did
know.
I, yeah.
Which reminds me of something I was going to say earlier, is I remember reading the Riverfront Times, which was and still is, the free weekly, like alt-weekly in St. Louis, Missouri, where I grew up. And it was what you were talking about. At the end of 1999, someone like reflecting, like, look at what a great year this is, and they named all these movies named one we haven't even named yet, South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut.
Oh, gosh, right. I love that movie.
On the list.
Yeah.
But then this critic was like, but I'm not including American Beauty. Everyone loved American Beauty, and this critic was the first one, because the internet wasn't, I wasn't really on the internet that much yet. I wasn't used to contrarianism, and it like blew my mind. I was like, how can this person not like American Beauty? And it's so funny now that it only took me a few years to revisit it and realize that I don't think it holds up very well.
I genuinely think you and I were at the perfect age for that to be a mind blowing movie. I saw it several times in the theater. It's like, man, this is really like, you know, really questioning things.
Because you were 16, you were 17. That's pretty much a good age to be like, the suburbs are not what they seem.
Yeah.
But and I had a weird experience with American Beauty, and I interviewed Alan Ball and Sam Mendes and Thora Birch for the book, and they were all delightful. I didn't interview Kevin Spacey, and it was this book was reported during the Weinstein Spacey thing, which changed some. There were a couple American Beauty people who wound up canceling their interviews, I think, because they didn't want to.
Of course, unfortunately, you couldn't interview Conrad Hall, which I think is the best part of the movie.
Oh, it is the best part. But you know, I saw when I was at Entertainment Weekly that year, they were so, and I have reminded people who I love and respect dearly who've turned on American Beauty, I'm like, you were in the hallway talking about how great this movie was. So I went to a screening like 2 weeks before it opened, and I had taken my friend, and I was like, I've heard this movie is amazing. And we sat there and we just kind of laughed, like, this is so, I was like, this is so lame. And I really didn't like it. And you know, I have to say, I watched all these movies again just for research, like commentary tracks, or just rewatching and trying to live with them. And I watched American Beauty a lot, and I was kind of dreading it. And I watch it now, and I'm like, I still don't love this movie, but you know, it was definitely, if you look at it now in 2019, it's like, this is a movie that was actually kind of pretty spot on. Like, I thought it was so broad and comedic, but it's like the idea that you're going to have these teenagers who are going to joke about violence and live through their screens, and you're going to have this neo-Nazi living next door in this very pristine suburb, and you're going to have Kevin Spacey playing a skeevy middle-aged guy. It's like, this movie was actually a little bit more ahead of its time. You know, it's like, but also it is a great looking movie. And I think that movie, what everyone was kind of, I was just talking about to say with someone, but like people were, you know, some people, the people who were sneering at the time, and there weren't a lot because I felt like I was alone and just like, but they were like, oh, it's just a TV movie and people are watching on these new Oscar screeners. And that's why. But if you look at the look of that movie, like it does. It's a great small screen / big screen movie. And I do think if you look at some of the prestige TV shows that came, it's like you can see Conrad Hall's visuals. I mean, the way stuff's framed, I mean, it really did. I think that movie is beautifully, beautifully put together. Yeah. And even now the Thomas Newman score is so overplayed, but like it works perfectly in that movie.
Yeah.
And there's some, I've even come around on the bag scene only because I'm like, you know what? When I was that age, I said some really stupid stuff too. That is what a stupid teenager who's a stoner who thinks things are profound will say. And as I get older and more new agey in my life, I'm like, you know, sometimes a floating bag maybe really is kind of beautiful. And I would, if I had told some of my friends that I would be 20 years later, I'd be kind of reversing myself on American Beauty. They would not believe it in 1999 because I was so anti it. Cider House Rules of Green Mile, I never liked. And I just can't, I tried to watch Green, I had to watch Green Mile again for this and Cider House Rules. And I was just like, I can't deal with these movies right now.
Well, I guess maybe it's just the pro-choice activist in me still likes Cider House Rules.
It lost Best Adapted Screenplay to Election, which to me is like, that's a Metallica Jethro Tull thing. It's like it defeated Election for, which to me is like insane. Like Election is like one of the best adapted screenplays I think ever. I love that movie so much, and for that to go to Cider House Rules is so weird.
And as much as I love Michael Caine in general, I think his performance is fine in the movie, but that was a strong year for supporting actor.
Yeah.
You had Tom Cruise, you had Jude Law, you had Haley Joel Osment, and you had, you know, Green Mile's not great, but I do really appreciate Michael Clark Duncan's like commitment to his performance. Yeah. And I think the least deserving guy actually won that year.
Yeah, they were trying to make up for not giving it to him for Jaws of Revenge. It was a classic makeup Oscar. I mean, all those categories, you can go all through all those categories and knock out two or three. It's like, how did Reese Witherspoon not get nominated? How did, I mean, even Matthew Broderick, it's like, how did Norton or Pitt not get nominated? Like, you know, I don't know which category you put them in, but like, those are really good performances. Helena Bonham Carter, that's a great performance. Yeah. You know, I do think Cruise should have won. Like 1999 is like, you know, Tom Cruise is kind of a supporting character in the whole book. Cause he had a very, I mean, between Eyes Wide Shut and Magnolia, it's like, you know, I've talked to people who are really young who only know Tom Cruise as a guy who hangs on helicopters and lives in a giant, I don't know, sort of actual bubble made of gold or whatever, but that was a huge risk for him to make those two movies. They're movies that were so anti the Tom Cruise brand at that time. It's like they're movies about sex, and they're dark, and they're emotionally violent, and it's like, it was crazy that he did that.
And it would appear that it jarred him into action for the rest of his life.
I mean, he does Collateral. He does it, which is kind of a thriller drama hybrid, but yeah, he never really quite goes back to that. I mean, I think he was trying. I think I have a lot of, I don't know how much time you guys have. I love Tom Cruise. I can talk about it forever, but I do think he took those two movies and tried to improve the way he made action movies. Like, if you look at War of the Worlds and Minority Report, I think he's better in them than he was in, say, I don't know, you know, any of the early 90s, like Days of Thunder or something. Like, I think he really was trying. I think he learned a lot about performance, but I just think he was never going to make, like, I'm sure after Magnolia, he was like, this was fun. This movie did not make $250 million, unlike all my other movies, so why am I even doing this? And why am I going to spend 2 years with Stanley Kubrick in London for a movie where it ends in divorce, ultimately?
Which is actually a funny part of Michael Caine's Best Supporting Actor win speech, where he goes through, he's very gracious, talking about all the other nominees, and then he says Tom Cruise, he goes, oh, do you have any idea what supporting actors get paid? Yeah. And it was very funny.
A couple of thoughts I had about, you mentioned, I was 16, I turned 17 at the end of 1999, and I was a budding cinephile, but there were a couple of things that I was reminded of that made me realize I was a bit further along, I was already further along than the mainstream.
Sure.
First off, my parents and their friends were scandalized by Kevin Spacey masturbating at the beginning of American Beauty. Mm. And I was like, clearly you guys have not been renting indie movies, like American indies. I've seen so many guys masturbating in movies over the past few years. And the other thing I remember,
just in the theater.
me and Paul Rubens and Fred Willard going to the movies together. And the other thing, Tyler, you mentioned, I had forgotten that Sixth Sense was nominated for Best Picture. I remember a girl in my drama club in high school being like, the weekend before the Oscars, being like, well, obviously Sixth Sense is going to win.
Oh yeah.
It's obvious. Whereas I was already savvy enough to know, like, no, the nomination is the win for the Sixth Sense. It's not going to win Best Picture. But they were like, it made the most money of any of the movies. Yeah.
I had my Oscar pool at the time, back before we did our fantasy awards draft.
Yeah.
And so, like, all my friends were over, and everyone threw in like 50 cents a category. And then if no one had the winner in a category, they just carried over to the next one. And similarly, Sixth Sense. Of course, your friend would say Sixth Sense. It's the only one they saw, you know. Yeah. And similarly, I was the only person in my group of friends that went for Michael Caine because I knew how the Oscars worked. Everyone else was like, obviously it's going to be Haley Joel Osment. Obviously, it's the only one they saw.
Yeah.
And so when I won, and I just like, and I just like pulled in like all these,
at the end of the opening
exactly.
Titles. Yeah.
And a friend was like, how the fuck did you know that? It's like, because I. Because he's the older guy and he hasn't won in a while, so it's fun being a know-it-all asshole.
I think what you spoke to is really interesting, and I haven't thought about this in a while, but why American Beauty won. And I think it was because by the end of the 90s there was all this momentum in the indie community. I think maybe Academy voters were like, we have to really kind of catch up with this, and American Beauty is clearly like, of that, this is an edgy movie. And I think had that movie come out in like 89, it probably would have seemed a lot more shocking to have Kevin Spacey masturbating in the shower. But I do think that now, I think by 99, I think for me at that point, I was 23, I was like, this is not, like, I've seen edgier stuff than this. Like,
I've seen Bad Lieutenant.
Yeah, I've seen Bad Lieutenant. Yeah, unfortunately, I had seen Bad Lieutenant, actually. Now I'm thinking about it, I'm like, oh yeah, I saw those 18 movies where Harvey Keitel got naked in the mid-90s. You did a lot of those, I feel like. I felt like they were like, this was the, I think they thought that was the movie with the most integrity that year. But it is weird. Like, it was also the whole fascinating thing about American Beauty is that it was the same year. It was the year after Harvey and DreamWorks had that huge public, like, Shakespeare in Love, Saving Private Ryan kerfuffle, and Hollywood really turned against. I mean, Hollywood turned against Harvey in a big way 2 years ago, but 99 was definitely like a bad year for him. Like, Miramax did not, literally and figuratively, did not get Blair Witch. They didn't understand it. They didn't buy it at Sundance. They bought Happy Texas for $10 million, which is a crazy, crazy lease. I mean, that's like such a ridiculous choice. And, you know, they didn't have a great, they had She's All That, which was a huge hit. And they had Ripley, which is a beautiful movie, which I love, but that Harvey couldn't get the Oscar momentum for. And I think there was a little bit of like, screw Harvey. We're not giving Cider House Rules Best Picture. We're not giving the Miramax movie Best Picture. It's like, and we're giving it to Steven's company. company. Because I do think American Beauty had its admirers, but I think there's also, that was one of the first years where you could really see the Oscar politics playing out in the press. Those guys, those two companies were going out at each other in the press. It's kind of a fascinating, I cut all that from the book because I feel like Oscar stuff can be a little inside baseball sometimes, but it was really, to go back through those clips and be like, oh, this was kind of a nasty battle in the late 90s for these awards.
And I do think, given how we've just been talking about the 90s, if you look at the best pictures of the 90s, you've got
the best picture winners.
The best picture winners.
Yeah.
You've got Dances with Wolves. Okay. Then you have like Silence of the Lambs. Surprising. Yeah. Unforgiven. Kind of surprising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Schindler's List. Not surprising. Forrest Gump. Braveheart. English Patient. Titanic.
Yeah.
And then like, okay, well, they go a little bit off with Shakespeare in Love, but even then, not that out of the way. But like, for a decade that is as edgy as the 90s are, they go with a lot of like big historical epics for best picture, and American Beauty does seem like an antidote to that. And then it's like, okay, enough of this. Gladiator, best picture, followed by A Beautiful Mind, and you know, so
keep going. What won in 2002?
Chicago, and then Lord of the Rings.
Oh wow, yeah, yeah,
and then 2004 was Million Dollar Baby.
Okay,
so but yeah, so like it's. It did seem like almost like Shakespeare in Love and American Beauty did sort of seem like the Oscars trying to zig instead of zag.
Yeah. And American Beauty was a huge mainstream hit. I mean, it was, it made it over $100 million. Yeah. It's like, mm-hmm. it's like a lot
like
of these
said,
movies.
My parents saw it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like a lot of these movies made $100 million that were completely never franchised and not seen. I mean, there weren't a lot of sequels that year, which is really crazy. And I think that's one of the, I think that's why part of the warmth, the nostalgia for that year is like, when you look at that list, it's all like, oh, I know that movie. I'm not confusing you with the sequel. It's like, I know. I was like, I remember Notting Hill. There was no Notting Hill 2. It's like, I know. It's like, oh, I know Notting Hill. I know even like stuff like Bowfinger, people are like tweeting, like Bowfinger, why isn't Bowfinger in your book? I'm like, Bowfinger was great. That's too much stuff. It's like those kind of movies, like everything was new and original. And I think those do stick with you, especially when they arrive kind of at that time, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
What are the biggest sequels of 1990?
Austin Powers. Well, Phantom Menace. Toy Story 2, Austin Powers. I mean, obviously Phantom Menace, but that almost doesn't, I feel like that almost doesn't count.
Yeah.
It feels just like a total, like, I mean, in a way it was something entirely new and interesting, but those were the real big ones. I don't think there was one or two other ones, but it was definitely not a year driven by sequels. And it was also when I talked to a lot of the filmmakers and executives, like by the end of the 90s, like they really were starting to be like, sequels and reboots are kind of tacky. Like we're kind of moving away from that because they'd had some big sequels, but they'd had all these big remakes and reboots fail. Like it was in all these franchises.
Wild Wild West.
Yeah. Wild West was 99. So it's like, that's one of the few reboots, but like,
that's the one I told my parents I was seeing when I was going to see Eyes Wide Shut.
I don't think you were alone in doing that. I think South Park benefited from like a lot of kids saying they're going to see Wild Wild West.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think South Park didn't get the box office it should have, but like, you know, they were making the late 90s, like the Alien franchise stalled out, Beverly Hills Cop franchise stalled out, like even like
Lethal
something
Weapon.
Like Lethal Weapon was like, it did okay, but they spent so much money to make Lethal Weapon 4. It's like, and like they tried to make a Babe movie, so, and then there was also Lost in Space and The Odd Couple 2, and there's all these TV things that were, and
right.
I think the executives were like, we have to actually, like, this is kind of gross that we're doing this, we have to make some new stuff. And I think that started especially post Titanic, where they're like, let's make new ideas. Let's not just, because the sequels are, Batman versus Robin was like traumatizing for Warner Brothers. It was like,
now they weren't actually fighting each other.
Oh, sorry, that's right. I keep calling it Batman versus Robin. But it, you know, well, it should have been actually, that would have been a much better movie.
Oh,
even
yes,
been Batman versus Robin. I would have loved that. But yeah, like Batman and Robin was like, at Warner Brothers, they were like, this is a, they're, everyone's like, we all know this is a bad movie. Like this is not, and it didn't do well. And I think they were like, this is the Golden Goose is kind of like walking out of the door, you know. So they, I think they felt like they had to do something new, or maybe they're just spinning it that way 20 years later to make themselves seem noble.
I think it speaks to the general distaste for sequels in like the late 90s that Independence Day did not get a sequel, like up until what,
eventually,
a couple years ago.
And
that's a film that made tons of money, and I feel like certainly in modern thinking, of course that would have a sequel 2 years later.
Yeah.
How could it not? But yeah, they just it was, up until recently, it was a one-off, which is crazy to think about.
It's so weird. I've always wondered about that. And I wonder if it was because Will Smith didn't want to do it, or I wonder if the next year Fox was like, we're putting out this movie Titanic. It's like, we don't have to make any movies for 5 more years. We just made a gazillion $1 billion. It's like, but yeah, no, certainly, like, I don't think they were stamping them out. And they certainly weren't, like, proudly announcing them the day the first one comes out. Like, we're already moving ahead with part two. That was, that generation had really had been, of executives really kind of had been raised to be like, you know, Godfather 2, good good sequel. Rest of them, it's a little crass. No. There was still a stigma, which is like remarkable now when you like when you think of your film going now.
And I guess, yeah, I mean, if they were movie watchers in the 80s, it was just, here's another Superman, here's another mm-hmm. Friday the 13th, here's another Jaws.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And just feeling, not only are sequels, it's like, yeah, there's Aliens, hey, yeah. that's a win, but just like, these are really hacky.
Yeah, there were punchlines yeah. that you made fun of. It's like the joke in Spaceballs, like Rocky 5000. Yeah. It's like, oh, yeah. that was a laugh line because it didn't seem that far off, you know?
Back to the Future 2 itself, a sequel, has the Jaws 19.
Yeah. No, joke. I mean, they were seen as like a really crass, like they were like Happy Meals. It's like, why are we doing this? You know, it's another sort of, it was seen as kind of the more distasteful element of the industry, I guess.
So,
well, you said, Tyler, you said we were gonna
I don't know if we have time now.
Well, I just want to nominate the year 1946.
Okay.
Even though I haven't seen Gilda. I've never seen Gilda. But It's a Wonderful Life.
Okay.
Yeah.
The Big Sleep. Mm. John Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast. Mm. The Best Years of Our Lives mm-hmm. is 1946.
Pretty great.
A Matter of Life and Death is 1946. Notorious.
Mm-hmm.
The Postman Always Rings Twice. David Lean's Great Expectations.
That's a good year.
Orson Welles' The Stranger, not his strongest work, but still
interesting.
Good movie. Orson Welles made a movie that year.
What's it?
Orson Welles made a movie that year. That's notable.
Yeah. Robert Siodmak's The Killers. And this one's a little bit more obscure, but John Negulescu's Nobody Lives Forever, starring John Garfield, was a really cool noir movie. So, I don't know, Tyler, you told me off mic we were going to do that, so I had 1946 ready as a challenger.
That whole decade is, I mean, like I said, the 40s, 70s, and 90s, but you know what's I also am really fascinated by 1950, because it's like the best, it's like the year where Hollywood is making movies about showbiz, so that's the year. Sunset Boulevard,
All About Eve,
and In a Lonely Place,
but
you also get the Asphalt Jungle, which is not about Hollywood, which is just absolutely one of my favorite movies ever, but I'm like, the fact that like In a Lonely Place, All About Eve, and Sunset Boulevard, probably in some theater somewhere, were all showing around the same time.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Wow. It's amazing to me.
Also Rashomon, Flowers of St. Francis, Gun Crazy.
Oh yeah. No, that's the, I mean, the 40s, I mean, in 1950 is still kind of part of the 40s. Like, that's a remarkably ripe decade.
Yeah. It's like, I can imagine somebody watching All About Eve, Sunset Boulevard, and In a Lonely Place, like all in one weekend.
Oh my God.
And they're like,
depressing.
And they come out and they're like, does Hollywood like itself at all?
Yeah. No wonder they started thinking, well, what are all those communists doing? We're going to drive those crazy people out of the country.
Don't they realize how successful they are?
Yeah. Gosh, I just watched In a Lonely Place again like 2 or 3 months ago. And I put it on with my mom. I was like, let's watch this really great old Bogart noir. And I was like, oh, I forgot how depressing this movie is. That the final 2 minutes are just,
It's always,
I love it, but yeah.
It's always fun when somebody like Bogart, who is this, you know, firmly established Hollywood actor, when he was willing to take risks and seem really unlikable, like in The Caine Mutiny, I'd say Treasure of the Sierra Madre, but especially In a Lonely Place, where his character is just...
Yeah, and he was producing these movies, too. Yeah. He was okay. I mean, he really was like, these are the movies I want to make, are movies where I play a pretty broken guy. Yeah.
Almost irredeemable, I would say, in A Lonely Place.
Oh, In a Lonely Place, but when the time he beats the guy up on the side of the road, you're like, this guy is a monster. So it's such a dark movie.
Yeah. Have you ever seen In a Lonely
Place? Oh my God.
It's
really great, yeah.
You'd love that kind of dark stuff. So I do think, David, I don't think you've actually met him, but Stephen Farber, who was my film criticism professor at UCLA, he is going to be releasing a book sometime soon.
It's called 1946, Best Movie Year Ever.
I don't know the actual title, but he says 1962, and I helped him. I was interning for him for a while, and so I helped him do some research and gather some materials and stuff. And I don't think I agree, but it is a pretty amazing year.
All right, let me write some down.
Okay.
Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah.
Cleo from 5 to 7.
Mm-hmm.
The Exterminating Angel. The Manchurian Candidate. To Kill a Mockingbird. Jules and Jim. Cape Fear. The Music Man. Dr. No. Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
Yeah.
The World's Greatest Sinner, which is a specifically terrible movie, but great.
Yeah.
Those are all 1962.
I think Two for the Road is that year, and that's a movie he loves. I think everybody kind of has their like a year that they really respond to. I really like 75, but I'm a big fan of
75.
Nashville.
Oh my gosh.
I think 76 is pretty amazing, 76 too.
76 is great. I mean, the 70s is, I mean, certainly 67 to 82, it's like, it's probably, as much as I love the 40s and 90s, like, that is just if I made a top 100, those 12, 13 years would absolutely dominate it.
Well, 75 is a contender.
75. Yeah. The best picture nominees are what? I want to guess with Nashville, Jaws, Barry Lyndon, Dog Day Afternoon. Oh, what's the fifth one? Because it's so. What's the fifth one?
It's the winner.
Was it Solo?
Oh, was it One for the Cuckoo's Nest?
One for the Cuckoo's Nest.
All right. But not Solo. No, okay, yeah. So,
they nominated that for screenplay.
Monty Python and the Holy Grail, also a movie that's easily in my top 10 of all time. Picnic and Hanging Rock is 1975. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mentioned Barry Lyndon.
The Man in the Glass Booth is that year, I believe.
Jean Dielman. Is 1975. I mentioned Solo. Fox and His Friends is also, and there's also Rollerball, which is a terrible movie.
Well, now wait a minute. Rollerball is a terrible movie. That's a whole different. But I mean, I very much enjoy both Rollerballs. The first one for the movie itself. The second one for the complete behind the scenes drama of a disastrous John McTiernan production.
How weird is it that John McTiernan remade two Norman Jewison movies? Because he did the Thomas Crown Affair, and Rollerball
in 1999. Thomas Crown Affair. Yeah. I mean, nothing is normal about John McTiernan. I mean, it's like that. That's like 18th on the list of weird things about aside the fact that he just got out of prison years ago for an incredibly convoluted case that I couldn't even begin to condense.
Yeah. I also like that George C. Scott wound up playing two roles originated by Lee J. Cobb.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, you're right. 12 Angry Men remake, and what's the other one I'm missing?
The Exorcist.
Mm. Oh, okay.
Yeah, but I mean, these are all. That's the thing is, that's why this is fun. It's like, and I, you know, I've said this a couple of times, and I don't mean it disingenuously. Like, I would love if someone who's really young is like writes a best movie year about like 2017 or 2018 and makes a really good case. Because I love the fact that like when I was younger, the canon was pretty much set. It was like basically like Citizen Kane. I love Citizen Kane, but like every year there'd be a big list of the top 100 movies and it would always be almost the same. And then there was that weird, like at some point it shifted between Citizen Kane and Vertigo, and that was like a whole
2012.
But it's like, I really love the fact that now people who are much younger than me are making the case for the movies of their generation that maybe I didn't quite get, or that I have to take a second look at. I like that a lot. I mean, I and I'm excited people are interested in movies enough to argue about them still. That makes me very happy. And so, you know, if they want to argue with me on Facebook, that's totally fine. I'm more than happy to make my case and to listen to theirs.
Last thing I want to topic on the table, which is best movie year since 1999, although I feel like 2007
is. I think it's 2007, though. I was really down in 2016 about movies till the end of the year, but 2017, I really felt like for the first time, my friends who were movie nerds who just had kids and couldn't go to the movies anymore were like texting me like, whoa, Get Out, whoa, Lady Bird, yo, have you seen Call Me by Your Name? It was just like, I did feel like that year a lot of movies were connecting, and I really, and Phantom Thread was 2017, right?
Yeah.
I absolutely love Phantom Thread and could watch, that's become Goodfellas now where I'm like, but it's on, we're going to sit down and watch Phantom Thread for 2 hours. But like, I felt like that was a really, really strong year. I love 2007.
Yeah.
But I think 2017 was just like, I love Lady Bird so much. It made me so happy. I saw it twice in the theater. I saw Get Out multiple times in the theater, and I really felt connected to those movies just as an experience of being a moviegoer again.
I think that's a great case for 2017. The one I was going to nominate, you might have bested me there, but I was going to nominate 2011. You've got The Tree of Life, Melancholia, A Separation. You've got Your Next, Take Shelter, Margaret. You've got
That's such a good Your Next and all those movies. That's a great. It's a really interesting lineup.
Yeah. And I like the last Harry Potter movie.
Like Moneyball more than you do, but I do love Moneyball. Right.
You've got The Raid. You've got Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Bernie and Young Adult are both, I think, great movies. Goon is, I think, one of the best sports movies in the 21st century. The Innkeepers is a great movie. The aforementioned Project Nim is 2011.
I think
2011 is
as far as the U.S.
Lean Haywire.
As far as the U.S., I think you've got Certified Copy in 2011. I think it was officially a 2010 movie as far as country of origin. But 2011 is a good year.
Melancholia and You're Next and Moneyball. It's a pretty good lineup. Those are all movies that I saw when they came out. I saw them again 2 years later, and I'm like, I'd like to rewatch all three of those. I mean, I don't want to put on Melancholia just to hang out and kick off my shoes, but I love that movie.
I know that's one of those Blu-rays that I have, and I'm like, I just see it, and I'm like, not today. One of these days, I'll throw on that Blu-ray.
I wish he were not such a nut because I feel so uncomfortable liking his films. But boy, I really really dug that. And I watched that and I was like, oh man, that guy should, that's the guy who should make Dune. Like that's, I was like, that was a kind of dark sci-fi that like felt really grounded. That, yeah, I really loved
that. Did you see The House that Jack Built?
No, I've not seen it.
It's, I'm glad I watched it. It's,
yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it's an experience.
Yeah. I just suffer for me to see those with kids. Cause I'm like, oh boy, who's going to walk in on what? But I, it's on my list to see for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I do think, I don't know. It's tough because I'm trying to think, okay, so is it about the number of movies that are great or like if there are five masterpieces in a certain year, like does that make it a great year?
Because is it the way those movies fed what came? I mean, that's like one thing I like about 99, and not just because I wrote a book on it, but like I did think that if you look at 39 and 69 and 79, those, like they do kind of all feed into 1999, and then 1999 creates these movies like The Matrix or Malkovich that wound up, however, in some like big ways or small ways, kind of feeding the next 20 years. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's why I picked it. I mean, that's why I'm now I think of it, it's like it maybe just sits at that point of history where Hollywood's almost 100 years old, and movies itself almost 100 years old. It's like, you know, but certainly when you look, when you listen to those 1962 movies, I'm like, oh boy, that would be a really fun year to go to the movies every weekend. Like, and maybe I don't know, maybe it's a mix of things, you know?
Yeah. I think that actually is a really interesting thing is like, if you were to just look from one weekend to the next, could you go to see a movie every week and it's amazing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And I'd say 99 is pretty damn close. Cause you also had the emergence of stuff like American Pie.
And, oh yeah, yeah. You know, teen movies were huge that year, and those weren't my. You guys were that age. So I was when I wrote the teen movie chapter, I felt a little off balance because I'm like, these are not my teen movies.
Right.
Like I, by the time I was 23, I was like, I don't watch high school movies unless it's Rushmore or The Virgin Suicide. Yeah.
But I was also very specifically the kind of teenager not watching.
You were like, I'm not watching the latest.
Like now I want to go back and watch 10 Things I Hate About You because people my age were into those movies. Say that one's great.
That for your generation, that movie is like the response to that movie. It's like and I like it. I love the two screenwriters are really great. I interviewed them in the book. I like that movie. It's very charming, but like that movie for people who are 5 or 6 years younger than me, it's like absolutely it's their 16 Candles, it's their Breakfast Club. And I totally get it. But the love for that movie is really kind of insane. Yeah.
Yeah, which is making me want to revisit. I remember seeing when it came out and not really feeling very strongly either way about it. But I was probably because I was not in the headspace. Now I love romance movies.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff.
At that time I lived in southern Missouri, so while all the other teenagers were watching in the rest of the country were watching 10 Things I Hate About You, it was all about Varsity Blues.
Oh yeah.
You know, I Don't Want Your Laugh and stuff.
Very
like
weird
that.
Movie. A genuinely weird movie. Like I really enjoyed rewatching that because it's like there's so many strange things in that film, like the younger brother who in every scene has like a new religion and you're like, what is this stuff about? What is this doing in this movie? Like it's really cool and weird, but I'm like, I have no idea what it's doing in this movie.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, it's also those, you know, those teen movies came out the year of Columbine, and it's like you watch Varsity Blues, it came out in January, and there's a scene where James Vanderbeek shoots the coach's picture with a shotgun, and I'm like, oh, well, you can, this is like right before, but you would never do this. It's like 3 months later, you could never put that in an American high school movie for the next 15 years. It's like those movies really capture like that pre kind of Columbine high school life, and it's when you watch them now, they're all the more poignant because of that, you know.
Well, this has been great. We ended up talking almost exclusively about 1999, but
Sure, why not?
Why not? Yeah. That's what the book's about. Yeah. So, real quick, of course, you can find us at BattleshipRetention.com. There's all sorts of movie reviews. My review of Endgame is up this week, and my review. Hopefully, by the time you're hearing this, I'll post my review of Ralph Fiennes' The White Crow.
Oh yeah,
not worth seeing, but read my review. That's at Battleship Retention. You can email us at David@BattleshipRetention.com or Tyler@BattleshipRetention.com. Check out the Patreon at patreon.com/battleshippretension. This week we did our TV journal. We got something else coming up in a couple days. Let's see, I'm on Twitter at Davey Pretension. Tyler's on Twitter at Tyler Pretension. Real quick, anything to plug for More Than One Lesson?
My writer Reed went to the screening for Avengers Endgame, and so he wrote a very in-depth article about it, and was, I'd say, primarily favorable about it, but kind of on board with you in a lot of ways.
Brian, what do you have? Where can people find you?
I'm a Twitter at Brian Raftery, and I just obnoxiously tweet to promote my book right now. So it's you can look it up and then mute me for the next 2 weeks. I don't blame you. And the book is, it's everywhere. It's on Amazon. It's called Best Movie Year Ever, How 99 Blew Up the Big Screen. And it's fun. And I'm writing stuff next coming month for The Ringer and Vulture and other places. So I just use Twitter at this point to make bad puns or promote myself. Sure. I don't know which one one of those is more shameful, honestly. Yeah. Probably the puns, but that's where you can find me. Yeah, and this book, by the way, the book is excerpted. You can read the Fight Club chapter on The Ringer. You can read the Matrix chapter on Wired.com. Three Kings is on Slate, and the Wise White Chef chapter is on Vulture. So if you want to read all four chapters for free and then not buy the book, okay, I get it. But it's, you know, you can check it out, the book, there if you want to.
Yeah, don't you hate when you make it what you think is a really great pun on Twitter and it gets like nothing?
I make puns all the time in a house where everyone just frowns at my puns. So making bad puns that no one wants to hear is kind of my, it's kind of my thing. Yeah,
I tweeted, I did the like period at thing so someone can, everyone can see. I tweeted at Nicholas Holt the other day, "Are you talking to me?"
That's pretty good.
No response.
Nothing.
Not a couple of people were like, "That's pretty good," but I got nothing. I should be on fucking, I don't know. I should be featured on, I don't know. Best week ever. That doesn't exist anymore. Yeah,
that was a good. Well, if you like puns, about a couple months ago, I went through all my Circa 99 EWs and I tweeted out the best headline puns from that year. Oh. EW was the greatest pun resource at that point. So there are some really good bad puns in the late 90s that I will direct you toward that are pretty delightful. It's the only good thing I've ever done on Twitter is tweeting out a bunch of old EW puns.
I can't wait. Yeah. I gotta find that. Thank you for being here.
Sure. Thank you. This is so much fun, guys.
Yeah,
I appreciate
this is a blast. Thank you at home for listening.
We'll get you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the battleship Pretension Fleet.